This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are humans changing the planet so much that we've entered a new geological age? They call it the Anthropocene, and we don't know if that's good. Our first guest from Berlin, Christian Schwagerl, literally wrote the book on it. Then we'll hear a different view from two ecofeminists, American Green Party founder Charlene Spretnak and author Susan Griffin. First to Berlin.
Yes, this bustling world of a thousand moods reflects the dreams of its ambitious inhabitants, dreams already realized of man's triumph over nature.
Radio EcoShock.
I received an invitation to read a book newly coming out for English readers. The title is The Anthropocene, The Human Era, and How It Shapes Our Planet. Little did I know how deep and sometimes disturbing this adventure into ideas would become. The author is Christian Schwagerl. He's been one of the best environmental journalists in Berlin for 25 years. Christian holds a Master of Science degree himself. When the first German version of this book was published as Mensch sein Zeit, or The Age of Humans, the head of the United Nations Environment Program, Achim Steiner, spoke at the book launch. From Berlin, Christian Schwagerl, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, and thanks for having me on the program.
Well, of course, we must start with the definition of what the word Anthropocene means. That can take a couple of chapters, I know, but would you give us an introduction to its meaning?
The Anthropocene is a geological concept. It reflects how much we humans affect the planet, how much we are changing it. And I'm not just talking about climate. I'm talking about the way humans change the surface of the Earth, change the soils, change the course water runs, change the evolution of animals and plants, changes the biodiversity. So Anthropocene basically means that we humans have become the dominant force of change on Earth. And that our actions actually are not just, we're not just kind of scratching the surface of the Earth. We are changing the Earth system deeply. We are changing it fast, and we are changing it for a long time. So what we do now will be visible in the geological record for a long time. And that's why a Nobel laureate, Paul Crutzen, came up with this word to say, look, it's the age of humans in a sense that we are changing the geology, the biology, the chemistry of Earth for a long future. And in the future, it will be able to look back and see what we have done.
Yes, we can't really understand the Anthropocene or the movement developing around it without knowing a little bit about this famous scientist, Paul Crutzen. You've been involved with him over the years. How would you introduce Paul to our audience?
Yeah, Paul is a scientist who's not just interested in science. He's a great scientist. He started the research on the CFCs, those substances that are dangerous for the ozone layer. And he saw already in the early 70s that there are substances that are dangerous for the layer that protects the Earth from ultraviolet radiation. And he kind of triggered the research that led to the discovery of the ozone hole and to the political efforts to then ban the dangerous substances. And so Paul actually was involved also in the political campaign in order to ban these dangerous substances. So he's a man with a sort of broad horizon, and this ozone experience kind of made him think, you know, what else are we doing and what else might happen? So he kept being concerned, and he kept making these lists of things humans do with Earth and how we are changing basically the metabolism of Earth, the workings of the Earth system. And that's why in the year 2000, it was more or less, as he describes it, a spontaneous idea in a meeting in Mexico, a scientific meeting. People were talking of the Holocene, and that's, you know, in the school books you learn we are living in the Holocene. That's the geological epoch that has started roughly 11,000 years ago at the end of the last ice age. And that's what pupils learn today at school. You know, we live in the Holocene. And these scientists were talking about the Holocene. And in this meeting in the year 2000, Paul Crutzen stood up and said, no, we are not living in the Holocene anymore. We live in the Anthropocene, the age of humans or the epoch of humans. And it, as he describes it, people were stunned because this word really is very strong. The new age of humans, that's what it, that's the literal meaning of it is. And so, you know, he's now very excited. He's already almost 81 years old, and he's very excited now that this idea is kind of going viral at the moment.
Our listeners are environmentally aware people, Christian, and some are already thinking that naming an age after ourselves is just another example of our focus on everything human or anthropocentrism. How do you answer that?
Yeah, I think that's a very important concern. And I think it's important to actually avoid this sort of interpretation. And Paul Crutzen is kind of terrified by the idea that people might say, oh, great, it's the age of humans. Now we can do everything. You know, it's our age. It's the age of kind of engineering everything and of kind of human dominion over Earth. And that's not his way of thinking. You could actually argue that there's this danger that this word kind of makes us become even more anthropocentric. But my experience is different, because when you start realizing how much we do, and that's what the Anthropocene word captures, you know, how much happens on so many levels. And when you compare it with how much of it we understand, think about climate change or soil erosion or biodiversity loss, and if you compare it with how many of these changes have positive outcomes for ourselves, then you start realizing that it would be the most horrible idea to make the Anthropocene something anthropocentric, although the two words sound so similar. And my approach is that it's actually the total opposite, that through realizing how much we change, how much we interwoven we are with the Earth system, we come to realize that this is an age where we kind of find out how much we are part of nature. So this Anthropocene idea in a way makes us part of nature, something we have avoided in Western civilization. We've always tried to kind of put us above nature or outside nature and look at our economy. It extracts from nature, but it doesn't give any value to nature itself, to like untouched nature, to wilderness, to biodiversity. It's all zero value given to it. And so it's kind of blind to nature, and it always, our system, Western thinking, always tries to put us above nature. And the Anthropocene idea kind of roots us back into Earth geology and back into nature. And if you come out anthropocentric out of this process, I think something has gone terribly wrong. And my feeling is that the Anthropocene idea will actually make us less anthropocentric.
Good. Well, let's talk about the argument for naming a new age. You say humans have affected geology, chemistry, and biology. Why don't we just start with geology? Surely we can't have that much effect on rivers and rocks and the structure of the Earth?
Yeah, once you start looking into this, and I'm a biologist, so I was mainly concerned also in my writing with like things like biodiversity. But when you start looking at the actual geology of Earth, you start discovering that humans have already created something like 5 million mines on the planet, you know, spots where we have started to dig tunnels or create large open pits. Mountaintop mining is a very strong geological intervention. Think about cities, for example. I mean, you don't always have to think about the very negative things. Cities themselves are a geological thing. They are made of stone that has been brought from very different parts of the world in many cases, and glass and other synthetic materials. So they will form in the future when a geologist, say in a million years, a hypothetical geologist will look back, he will find a very funny layer of things of mixed stone that was a city. Other examples are, I mean, if you look at aluminium, like the isolated aluminium we use in the aluminium foils, there's so much aluminium extracted from the earth now and purified that you could cover the whole United States into aluminium foil. Or think about plastic. Plastic can actually become something like a stone. It kind of gets fossilized. And there's now enough plastic in the oceans and so on that you could wrap the whole Earth in cling film, which is also amazing. Think about the levels of like carbon dioxide that will remain in stones or in the ice if there is anything left on a warming planet in the future. That is also a sort of geological thing. Think about the radionuclides from the atomic tests and the actual bombs that were dropped. So these are artificial elements that will stay in the geological records for a very long time. Think about all the canals we have made, changing the course of water, and all of these things. If you, the list is really long, and when you add up the list, you come to a point where really we are changing geology to such an extent that future geologists will see our imprint. We are creating a geological record that will have a human imprint on it.
You had a couple of really fun ideas there. I think if we wrapped the world in plastic wrap, maybe it would keep longer, and it certainly would be fun to see America covered in tinfoil, even if only for a day. Well, has any official scientific body agreed to the Anthropocene, or will they do so soon?
Yeah, well, I think it's really important and good you're mentioning this. This comes from science. It's on the one side, it stays a scientific hypothesis. So there is a formal institution that kind of the people that are, you could call them the guardians of Earth time. So Earth is, what, 4.6 billion years old, and these people have the job to divide this history up into, like, chapters and subchapters and paragraphs and sentences. So you could kind of make it accessible for our understanding. So that's where you have the Cretaceous or the Devonian or the Jurassic, so these large kind of chapters of Earth history. And there's an international scientific body called the International Commission on Stratigraphy, who is kind of in charge of keeping Earth time and dividing it up. And this group has now set up a working group. It's called the Anthropocene Working Group, to actually look into the evidence. So to see whether what is captured by the word Anthropocene has a scientific reality. And that is a very strict process. There are strict scientific geological criteria that have to be met. For example, you need a global signal that is kind of very different from what happened before. For example, when the dinosaurs died out, suddenly there were no dinosaur bones anymore in the geological record. So you can basically draw a very good line there and say, okay, end of the dinosaur chapter, no bones anymore. Now, for example, today, you could say we now have billions of cattle that are slaughtered every year for our needs, and bones remain, and a lot of them are buried, or the chicken bones that get thrown away and end up in landfills. So in a future geological record, so 56 million years ago, you had suddenly the dinosaur bones went missing. But in the Anthropocene, the cattle and chicken bones, they come into the geological record. So these guys, they now make a kind of a long list again, or an analysis, whether geological criteria are met. And in 2016, so in 2 years' time, they want to come up with a first official vote. And the process is longer, but this will be a very important milestone. And the Anthropocene itself now inspires a lot of scientists to kind of reassess their work and do more about researching human-caused changes. It's one thing, for example, that the biological research stations, they're all kind of concentrated in the remaining wilderness areas, which is great. I mean, they have to be there. But 75% of Earth's surface is now modified by humans, and there are far too few biological research stations that kind of really explore the human-made changes. So now there's kind of this reassessment that we really have to look into this new nature, which we create on 75% of the planet's surface, which is modified, the agricultural deserts, for example, the monocultures and things like that.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock. Christian Schwagerl, the further I travel into your book, The Anthropocene, The Human Era, and How It Shapes Our Planet, I become a little uneasy, and it starts with your arguments for optimism. You grew up being a nuclear target in Bavaria, and yet now you say no apocalypse. Why not?
Right. Well, I think that it's really important to have this sense of urgency. I mean, with climate change and biodiversity loss and many other problems, plastic pollution in the oceans, we see a lot of things are happening fast, and we really need to do something now. You know, not something. We need to do a lot. We need to go into systemic changes, I think, in the way our economies are run, our politics sets priorities, and other things. So I don't want to play down anything. The problem is, and I have been, you know, socialized in a very kind of environmentally conscious area in Bavaria, and in my job as a journalist, I had a lot to do with environmentalists, and I admire a lot of them for what they do. But often I come into this sort of doom way of thinking, oh my God, we are lost, you know, and the earth is already kind of beyond hope, and the apocalypse is nigh, the end is nigh. And this kind of doomsday thinking, I think, stops us from developing really kind of creative ideas for how the future might look like, and also positive stories of how we want the world to look like in the future. And we leave these positive stories to the, you know, techno commercial guys who are selling, want us to shop us to death. And we're not kind of creating a counter narrative in a sense, because we say, well, you know, it's the apocalypse. Climate change will kill us all, and the planet is doomed already. And I think in the environmental movement in particular, there's a great need for spreading hope and spreading kind of positive ideas of what people with an environmental consciousness and conscience want the world to be. And this apocalypse idea stops us from it. I mean, there's this famous saying by the Protestant reformer Martin Luther, that if he knew the apocalypse was nigh and the world would end tomorrow, he would still plant an apple tree, right? One says that a lot here in Germany. I think it's wrong. I mean, if I knew the world would end tomorrow, I would not plant an apple tree. I would try and eat apple pie. So I think by saying the apocalypse is nigh, we are encouraging people actually to become even more short-term, to just have a big party and consume as much as they like, because, you know, it doesn't matter anyway. So we need to kind of go beyond that and say the problems are urgent, but we will have to live with them for a very long time. And our kids and grandchildren and all the other living beings we share the planet with, they will have to stick with what we are leaving them behind for a very long time, for the next, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, perhaps in some instances. Think about nuclear waste. So I think we, by creating this idea of a long future, we are actually increasing a sense of urgency and responsibility. And the apocalypse-type thinking makes people kind of hopeless, perhaps passive, or even worse, kind of, you know, think, you know, now let's have this final party. And you know, I don't think that's good.
Well, I'm going to ask you to explain your positive vision at the end of this interview, because I think that's a good way to wrap up. But first, I do have a couple of doubts about a couple of things you've written. For example, you say, even if climate change turns out to be worse than scientists at the IPCC fear, it will not lead to the end of the world or the collapse of civilization. This won't even come to pass if climate change, food crises, and cyber wars all occur simultaneously. Really, I mean, if the climate warms by 6 degrees or more in less than 200 years, as some scientists have suggested, you think civilization will still stand?
Yeah, well, it will be a very different civilization, and I'm not sure I would want to live in it or with it. It might be kind of, you know, military dictatorship that is really horrible, and it just kind of digging itself into the geology, perhaps, you know, people moving into the civilization, moving into caves. We have a very famous author here in Germany, Alfred Döblin, who kind of wrote a science fiction in the 1920s exactly about that, you know, a kind of techno-military dictatorship will move to the caves with, you know, high-tech civilization. So what I'm trying to say with this in the book is that we humans are very resilient. I mean, we're living from the polar areas to the tropics. We're living from the kind of along the seashores to the highest mountains. We are a very resilient species. And I'm not saying that our civilization, the way we live now, will persist. I'm just saying that a human civilization, most probably. I mean, I'm not a prophet. I can't really foretell the future. It's just what I'm trying to say is that there will not be a final curtain. You know, often in these kind of climate change diagrams, you see that in 2050 or now 2100, and then there is this end. And what I'm trying to say is, no, there is no end. You know, it will continue. If we change the climate by like 6 degrees, you know, we will have to live with it. That's basically my main point. And I'm not saying it will not hugely change our civilization. I just think that humans will still be around for a very long time, and they will have to live with what we do now.
And then you have a chapter called Directing Evolution, and I ask myself, who is going to direct evolution? Will it be a cabal of multi-billionaires? I mean, democracy's almost dead here in North America. Who would direct it? Monsanto, or?
Yeah, well, that's happening, and I don't like it. And I think that's really important to see that part of this Anthropocene that's happening is that humans gain the knowledge and also the power to really change organisms on a genetic level. We've been breeding animals for 10,000 years and changing plants for a long time, but now the methods to do that become more powerful. And that's why I think it's really important to have this democratic revolution to kind of reclaim evolution in a way so that not big corporations take it away from us, patent it, and then sell it back to us. I think that there needs to be, and I share your concerns about the crisis of democracy. But when we now enter a phase where we really design new organisms, perhaps we don't want to do this. This would be also a democratic decision. But we are changing organisms on so many levels globally that I think there needs to be a democratic approach to that as opposed to a very kind of narrow corporate process that makes just a few people rich and making the earth poorer. We need to see that it's not just about kind of clinging to old type nature. It's about how to design the process that creates new beings.
Well, as you write in your book, there has been a small debate from Andy Revkin in the New York Times to Elizabeth Colbert about whether that can be a good Anthropocene. You do wrap up your book with a personal vision of how things might not turn out so badly as many people think. Please take a minute or two to take us on a tour of how we might survive ourselves.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because if the Anthropocene as an idea would just be the sum of all environmental problems, I think then we would have to fight it. You know, then we'd have to say, you know, we must fight to stay in the Holocene. But I think part of the Anthropocene is to become aware of this global responsibility and to act. And so I think it's very inspirational to act and to change things. So, for example, I think that our lifestyles are very important. The way we connect with nature are very important. So I'm not a person who thinks that there are technological solutions, but I think technology plays a good role. And part of my scenario is that we really learn to imitate nature in a positive way, to create like cars that are biodegradable and electronic gadgets that are biodegradable. So to kind of make the technosphere part of the biosphere in a positive sense. So I have examples of that in my book of, this is very kind of fictional, of course, but of like bionic whales that are set free in the ocean to feed on the plastic in the ocean and to digest it, basically. Another example I'm giving, and that is of a social movement, is that I think China will be the hotbed of the next environmental movement. You have pressing environmental problems there, the smogs and everything, and you have a longing for participation. And I think I'm hopeful that Asia will see the rise of a new environmental movement. A third area I would like to mention is the question how our economy works. And I know this is problematic, but I think as long as money is so important, I think we need to start attribute some monetary value to what is important. And that is like something like wilderness or biodiversity. And you could say this is the final commodification of everything, and I'm scared of that as well. But as long as the money system is so important, I think, and that's part of my scenario, that through that, societies need to learn to reappreciate the value that is offered to us by living systems, by living wilderness areas, or functioning harmonic biocultural landscapes that are rich in biodiversity. So I think we need to broaden the horizon of our economic system to the what's really valuable, and nature is a big part of that. So my scenario kind of describes the process of realizing all of this and ending up in an Anthropocene that deserves the word good.
The book, The Anthropocene, The Human Era and How It Shapes Our Planet, is available now from Synergetic Press at a very reasonable price of just $10 for the paperback. The electronic version is coming soon. You can find links to all this, including a YouTube presentation by Christian Schwagerl, in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. Christian, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on the program.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
But we, who are all that are left of the old engineers and mechanics, have pledged ourselves to salvage the world. We have the airways, all that's left of them. We have the seas, and we have ideas in common. The brotherhood of efficiency, the freemasonry of science. We're the last trustees of civilization when everything else has failed.
I've been waiting for this.
Are we ready for tech nature and human creation of new life forms? Find more of my impressions on this book and links to the works discussed in this interview in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. It seems appropriate that we are now going to two speakers from the recent conference, Techno-Utopians and the Fate of the Earth. It was held in New York City on October 25th and 26th, 2014. This teach-in was presented by the International Forum on Globalization and the New York Open Center. It was recorded by Dale Lehman of WZRD Radio. I'm reversing the order of our speakers, starting with Charlene Spretnak on The Resurgence of the Real.
And our final panelist today will be Charlene Spretnak. She is the co-founder of the U.S. Green Party and the author of Green Politics, The Resurgence of the Real, Relational Reality, and many eco-social essays. She was named by the British government as one of the 100 eco-heroes of all time. And her newest book, The Spiritual Dynamic in Modern Art, was just published this week. Charlene will be speaking today on the importance of understanding organic, dynamic interrelatedness in assessing technology. Welcome, Charlene.
I'm going to come at this subject from a somewhat different direction, building on these astute critiques my fellow panelists have given about essentially a lot of examples they stated from what is the mechanistic worldview. And that, of course, has shaped our systems of knowledge. It shaped the way we were all socialized and the way we relate to technology. So the mechanistic worldview holds that every person and every entity is essentially separate and discrete. And entities, whether they're people or marsupials or poplar trees, they can be in some kind of relationship or not. But that certainly doesn't affect their internal constitution and the way they function physically. So that's the mechanistic perspective. But there's also a relational perspective, which acknowledges that every entity exists in a field of dynamic interrelationships. And they definitely do affect how your internal organ systems work and how you function in the world. And the interrelationships are dynamic, meaning they're always in flux, they respond to minute changes, they're creative, unpredictable, and full of possibilities. Now, even in the 19th century, there were some people who saw there are some real problems with the assumptions and premises of the mechanistic worldview. And really, there's been this attempted correction of it going on, at least since 1905 with Einstein's two papers, which established a relational perspective on matter and energy. But it's turned out that the mechanistic worldview has been very difficult to dislodge. And You may remember that there were a number of best-selling books in the last quarter of the 20th century, and these were all about the implications of relational discoveries in quantum physics, and then chaos theory, and then complexity studies. And these books asserted that soon this relational thinking from these discoveries would ripple out and transform all our institutions. Right. We can look around and see that our institutions were not transformed. And I think that's probably because the nature of those discoveries was too abstract for most people to pay a lot of attention to. So there was one partial success story, of course, from that period, which started out being called alternative medicine and then complementary medicine, integral medicine, which was eventually given a small, grudgingly given a small and very incongruous place in the mainstream medical system. But the millennial turning came and went, and I was still waiting to see the big correction, the grand correction to the mechanistic worldview. And I have to admit, I really got to a point where I thought, I may not see this. It may not happen in my lifetime. Okay, but then around 2004, I opened the newspaper one morning and I saw a small article, and it was on a discovery about the human body. And the researchers said they were very surprised by the findings. So I read that article, and I was very surprised by the findings. And then a few weeks later, I saw a similar one, and then I saw more in the months and years that followed. So I started saving all these because I saw that what these new discoveries had in common was that they were challenging the prevailing view of the human organism as essentially a biomachine, a very complicated biomachine. And these discoveries were actually revealing, they were revealing the extent to which the human organism actually is structured by and functions through dynamic interrelationships. So I had bulging files of this eventually, and I drew them all together and presented them in this book, Relational Reality, a couple of years ago. But they kept on coming, so I have another bulging file, and you'll see them now because you'll be able to recognize, oh, I see, that's another one that is showing these relational results that go against the mechanistic assumptions. So I'm going to give you just a few examples. One of them was they did a study a few years ago of 906 elderly adults, and they found that the ones that had few friendships or other social interactions had a rapid decline in motor function, standing, gripping, balancing. And then there was a study 2 years ago, 2012, this is about children, the development of children, and they found that children who between ages 5 and 10 experience violence, either physically being brought on them, or even witnessing violence, those children then had an erosion in the telomeres, which is part of the DNA structures in their cells, a shortening of the telomeres, which is what happens in the aging process. And the study found that the more types of violence the child witnessed, the faster the telomeres eroded, shortening their lifespan. So direct but even observed violence affects the human body at the cellular level. And then also our body-mind is in dynamic relationship not only with other people but with the rest of the natural world. So one study a few years ago of people who live in the projects in Chicago in this one housing project, it found that the residents who were at the far end of the project next to trees and green open space, they not only had less anxiety and depression, but they had many fewer incidents of physical diseases like diabetes, asthma, intestinal problems, and back pains. So there are so many, actually, recent discoveries about the relationship between humans and nature that you may have noticed that hospitals have now redesign their decor to have nature motifs, which costs a lot of money. So that's how established it is, only in the last 12 years with all this research. And if you've been in a hospital recently, you may have noticed the drapery often has a leaf motif. And in the patient's room, they've put a big photograph of a mountain scene. And in the corridors, they have these little water fountains, you know, with water running over stones. And sometimes in the MRI room, the last thing people see when they're being rolled in is the blue sky with white, fluffy clouds. So the reason they're doing that is because it's been very firmly established that connecting with nature, even through a photograph, helps our healing process. And I call this new field of knowledge that's emerging relational physiology. And it's different, I feel, because these discoveries, unlike the earlier ones, are so concrete and so accessible, and it's moving very quickly into mainstream areas. But what I'd like to focus on in the time remaining is just one of our organs, the brain, because it's always been held in the mechanistic view of the human body-mind, of course, that we arrive in this world with a certain capacity of mental functioning. You might be born smart or born dumb or something in between, but it's understood that you arrive with a certain kind of brain, and that's it. Now, however, that assumption is being strongly challenged by several studies that found there are numerous relational factors from infancy on through childhood that affect the development of an adult's level of intelligence. So here are five examples of what I call the relational physiology of intelligence. The first one's breastfeeding. So researchers have realized for a long time that breastfeeding is good for the physical reason that there are neurosugars in the breast milk that helps brain development. But now studies have also determined that the hours of interaction between the mother and the baby are exchanging all kinds of information through touch and language and other body language that stimulates brain development. And one study said that it controlled for lots of socioeconomic factors, but it said a baby who is breastfed for 1 year without other food being added yet gets a 6-point bounce on an IQ test, even though we know there are problems with IQ tests, but a standardized intelligence test. 6 points is what they determined. Number two, certain brain disorders. There's the example of autism. This is a new study that was just published last month by the University of California at Davis. You cannot make a definite diagnosis of autism before age 2, but as young as 6 months, certain symptoms start to show up, like rapid eye movement or fixation, unusual fixation on an object, or abnormal repetitive movements and not wanting to make eye contact. So this study identified a number of infants who were symptomatic between ages 6 months and 1 year, and it divided them into four groups. One of the groups got this therapy called Early Start, and they trained the mothers and sometimes both parents, how to do certain motions, certain sounds, often down on the carpet with the child, certain movements every day. And by the time these babies were 3 years old, the group that had had the early start intervention had no symptoms of autism, no language delays, and no other developmental delays. So this relational interaction had affected the brain and probably the synaptic pathways. And then number three, family dynamics. Well, about 25 years ago, it was noticed by some researchers that, again, drawing on the IQ test, the firstborn child, eldest child in a family, tends to generally, score 2 or 3 points higher on the IQ test than his or her siblings. So, of course, they figured it must be something going on with the brain of the firstborn. But in 2007, a study was done in Norway of 2,041 military records of 18 and 19-year-old boys who have to go into the service, And the researchers then, looking at these records, had not only the IQ score of the test the military had given, but it also had the family history of each boy. And what they found was, if the firstborn child had died early in childhood, or even if the first two children had died early and the thirdborn had been raised as the eldest, that child then scored the extra 2 or 3 points on the IQ test at age 19 that's generally seen of the firstborns. So family dynamics were affecting the development expression of intelligence. And they didn't speculate why, but, you know, parents tend to give the eldest child more responsibility, watch the kids, we're going out, and the eldest tends to identify more with the adult world and test-taking. It might have something to do with that, but they didn't say. And then, number four, violation and damage to the developmental process. It's been found in many studies, cross-culturally, that whipping, spanking, beating a child lowers IQ. And the more spanking, the more it lowers the IQ. And culturally, if it's accepted and expected that all children will be whipped or spanked, you can see culturally, collectively, the scores are suppressed, even factoring in for socioeconomic factors. So the violence is apparently an anti-relational trauma to the whole system. And then last, number five, language and the relational formation of our intelligence. A researcher named Betty Hart found in the mid-1990s that children who were exposed to a lot of language in conversation before age three did much better in reading and math and intelligence tests in school than children who had heard many fewer words during that period. So there's been a lot of studies recently working off of that and developing it. And one thing they found is that if the child was hearing a lot of words in conversation, not from the mother or primary caregiver, but rather from the television set, it not only didn't have the same effect, it had a detrimental effect on their intelligence abilities later. Before I go on, let me just say the baby Einstein device, do you remember that? Why that went by the by? When those children got to first and second grade, they had lower ability than the ones. So what I started to say before I thought of that, you cannot substitute the organic with the technological and expect that it's not going to be damaging. And that fact is apparently very widely recognized among high-tech parents in Silicon Valley. You may see in some of these articles in the paper where they go to these big names and say, wow, your house must be like an electronic cottage, the journalist will say. And the guy says, oh, no, we don't let our kids go on that. And they said, really, you don't? No, they, you know, either have no televisions and computers in the house or screen time, or at a certain age they'll let them have 1 or 2 hours a week. Or they send them even to Waldorf schools, no TV in the house. So one of the journalists asked these high-tech couples why they keep their children away from screen time, and they replied, quote, because we've seen what it does to people who were raised that way, unquote. Meanwhile, of course, their own company's marketing departments are just going full bore to convince parents all across the country that it'll benefit their child hugely to have them glued to a screen from infancy on, when, in fact, this electronic immersion is tremendously damaging to their development. So, in summary, even though it's 2014, we are just now beginning to grasp in mainstream venues that we human organisms are far, far more dynamically interrelated than modern thinking ever assumed. And of course, this deeply relational nature of reality was and is self-evident to indigenous cultures, but we hypermodern folks are pretty much at a kindergarten level of figuring out our own physical nature and how we work. It's not the way we were schooled. So one way for us to assess the effects of technology in our lives is to pay attention to whether time spent on an electronic device is significantly reducing the time and availability we need for organic relationships. But we face two difficulties in making assessments like that. First, because modern people are socialized in the mechanistic worldview, every new device seems really swell, and we're slow to see the detrimental effects. And second, because we do not yet recognize all that needs to be protected in this life, it's hard for us to make those assessments. But just keep in mind that we exist in, each of us, every moment, we're embedded in these gazillions of organic dynamic relationships. It's exhilarating. Thank you.
You just heard Charlene Spretnak, a founder of the U.S. Green Party, author and ecofeminist. Our next speaker from the forum Techno-Utopians and the Fate of the Earth is the famous ecofeminist Susan Griffin. Her topic is Women and Nature, Speed, Consciousness, and Quantification.
Next, I'd like to welcome Susan Griffin. Susan is a poet, essayist, playwright, and screenwriter. She's the author of over 20 books, including Women in Nature, which inspired the eco-feminist movement. Her book on nuclear weapons, A Chorus of Stones, The Private Life of War, was a New York Times notable book and a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Susan was named by Utney Reader as one of 100 visionaries for the new millennium. She's currently writing a book called Sustainability and the Soul, and her remarks today will reflect that work. Thank you, and welcome, Susan.
I contemplate a tree. I can assign it to a species and observe it as an instance. I can dissolve it into a number, but it can also happen, if will and grace are joined, that as I contemplate the tree, I am drawn into a relation, and the tree ceases to be an it. Those are the words that Martin Buber wrote in 1923 in his classic I, Thou. Along with Eileen and Tom and Lisa, you know, I think what we're stating here today is that what we have in our society today is an I-it, not an I-thou relationship with nature. And that I-it, by the way, relationship extends to various groups within our culture, the way we view indigenous peoples, the way we view women, the way we view people of color, is also tends to be more objectifying and closer to an it than a thou. But at the same time, you know, more science is discovering intelligence in the universe and in nature. Every day I learn about something, it seems that I learn about something new, some way that plants have intelligence, extraordinary. The abstract thinking of slime mold, have you heard about that? It's quite amazing. They can solve these incredible labyrinthine problems. But we still are hanging on to this experiential attitude. We may have a cognitive recognition of intelligence and or soul or an inner life in nature, but we hang on to this idea of the universe as essentially dead. And that creates some problems for us. It leads to global warming, it leads to economic inequities, but there's also another problem which is essentially psychological. And this psychological problem reinforces the economic and social attitudes that we have that are exploiting the earth. And that is that we can't have a meaningful relationship anymore with many of us with nature. And that's because it's very difficult to maintain or to even initiate a stimulating relationship with a corpse. So we've got some solutions, though. A solution like the steam train, which really inaugurated in many ways the Industrial Revolution. The steam train had another purpose. And that was, it functioned as a kind of mechanical Viagra, for both sexes, of course. It brought excitement back into life. Now, of course, the steam train promised a kind of utopia, as every new invention does. Mark Sekund, for instance, who was an inventor of the wide cable suspension bridge, you know, wrote that the enjoyment, the commodities of life, which had been reserved for only men of fortune, will be shared by all classes. Now, in fact, we know that that's not at all what happened with the Industrial Revolution, nor with the steam train, that the Industrial Revolution led to terrible economic inequality as People took the train into the cities. There was a surplus of labor. And in addition to that, children were exploited in labor. But clearly, at the same time, the steam trade had something really thrilling to offer, and Sequin talks about that. Long ribbons of iron along which rush, rapid as thought, those fordable machines which seem to eat up space with a spontaneous impatience and which seem almost alive in their breathing and their movement. So you can see the erotic nature of this great love of steam trains. So here's the incredible thing. The formidable erotic powers of the steam train seem to restore the life force that our worldview had stolen from nature, even while it was instrumental in destroying nature. Does anybody know what this is here? Bison skulls. So what would happen is on the steam trains that went west, one of the attractions of that rail trip to the west was that the train would stop in certain places where buffalo herds roamed, and the men on the train could get off and they could shoot. And so the buffalo almost became extinct. In the early part of the 19th century, speed itself became the object of adulation. It was worshipped by many, including especially the Italian writer and founder of a movement called Futurism, F.T. Marinetti. And I'm going to read you a few words from an essay he wrote called The New Religion, Morality of Speed. The futurist morality will protect man against the inevitable decay produced by slowness, memory, analysis, rest, and habit. Human energy, multiplied by 100-fold by velocity, will dominate space and time. Velocity has given human life one of the attributes of divinity, the straight line. Velocity is naturally pure, slowness is naturally unclean. After destroying traditional good and evil, we are creating a new good, speed, and a new evil, slowness. We intend to glorify war. This is from another piece that he wrote called The Futurist Manifesto. He wrote, "We intend to glorify war, the only hygiene of the world, militarism, patriotism, beautiful ideas worth dying for, and contempt for women." You see the way that all of these things fit together? Marinetti became, he was the head of what was the Futurist political party, which merged in Italy with the Fascist party. And he became a staunch supporter of Mussolini, leading to this. Doesn't that look like those bison skulls? You know, that's Florence after a bombardment in World War II. So seeing nature as dead, then we create our own deaths. But instead of questioning our worldview at any point, we simply accelerate our efforts to awaken ourselves, to re-stimulate ourselves. So we've come up with a new kind of Viagra, and that is electronic Viagra. So I thought of this when I saw an ad for some sort of, I don't know what it was, for some sort of software, something to do with computers. It was something that was a faster connection. It probably had to do with the internet, and it was faster because speed is the most important element that is advertised for anything in the world of computers right now. So it shows a guy, and he's getting this really fast connection, and he declares, "I never felt more alive." But actually, what a computer is it's a simulacrum of life, and it's dead. It's a dead simulacrum of life, what you're seeing on the screen. So once again, the claim was made with computers is that it's going to equalize everything. It's going to put us all on an equal footing, especially politically. We're going to be able to get the word out, and to some extent we can do that. But what the computer, with its speed, is best at is accumulating big data. And big data is very good for accumulating big wealth. So that's its main function in the business world. And I want to quote to you from Emma Uprichard, from the University of Warwick. She's a professor of sociology. And this is what she has to say about big data. It's being presented as the future problem solver for all things from breast cancer to low-cost governance, from better security to predictive systems, from smart cities and better traffic and water systems to an end to urban squalor. It promises cleaner, more sustainable, renewable energy, better banking, better governance, better education for all, more efficient, faster, more cost-effective everything. If we thought utopian authors were full of hope for better futures, the public discourse of big data is akin to a future fairy godmother with a magic wand granting wishes to help solve some of the world's most wicked problems. Of course, you know, I'm not arguing here against the collection of data at all. I love the data about the 99%, for instance, versus the 1%. There's some very important data that is also being, young people are being studied, and it's found, for instance, that in the United States, young people tend to be 75 times more violent than young people in other nations. So this kind of data is useful. But numbers are stripped of the earth. They're stripped of place. I mean, the numbers, the big data, the computers have realized Marinetti's dream. They're stripped of place, time. They're stripped of also of stories, breakfast, lunch, dinner, smiles, tears, empathy, emotional intelligence, not to speak of, in fact, the real erotic mysteries that come to us from sunrise, sunset, the night sky, a flight of birds, migrating south for the summer, or the eyes of somebody we love. Numbers don't have any of that. That's their virtue. They're supposedly objective, and therefore they're placed, by the way, above human responses and above us. For instance, you know, I hate public polls, and I hate polls of all kinds and questionnaires. For instance, if I'm asked, you know, have you ever been arrested? I would have to say yes, I was arrested. And then that would place me closer on a scale to a psychopath because I've been arrested. That's part of the data that makes you a psychopath. However, it doesn't ask me what I was arrested for or why I was arrested. I was arrested once protesting apartheid, once protesting the build-up to the war in Iraq, and another time because I refused to move when I was witnessing an incidents of police brutality. There's this other idea that somehow the data is never wrong, but it's often wrong because the data comes from ultimately a subjective viewpoint. This idea that an objective viewpoint is possible is not even possible in science, much less in social science. What we're doing is we're completing a sort of ultimate feedback cycle. Another way to think about it is that it's a very elaborate Ponzi scheme. You know, we're promised that we're going to get rich, but actually it's impoverishing us all. Not only is it impoverishing the environment, but we're starting to impoverish ourselves. When we impoverish our idea of the body and the way we heal and approach the body, that's a very serious lessening of ourselves, of our being. But what we're also impoverishing right now is consciousness. Ironically, we start with an epistemology saying there's an I and an it. And the I is supposed to be ensouled and have intelligence and empathy, and the it is an object. Now we're making consciousness itself into an it.
At this point, to meet our time limitations, I removed a few minutes of Susan Griffin's comments on education in the United States. We'll go to her conclusion, which follows from her beginning remarks.
I'm going to end with a quote, because there are many cultures that still do carry an understanding of nature as thou and live by that. And I'm going to quote you from a poem by the Senegalese poet. I'm going to end with these words. From the Senegalese poet Thiro Seydou Sall. Having become choreographers, the stars orchestrate in their white robes, tapestries of dreams, pain and joy, pulsations of love in the heart of life.
That was ecofeminist Susan Griffin. These presentations come from the New York City teach-in at the end of October called Techno-Utopians and the Fate of the Earth. Our recordings are courtesy of Dale Lehman of WZRD Radio. Find links to all this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info.
Now, we don't know if tomorrow is scheduled, so we want to be sure that we have enough money to enjoy our lifestyle today.
That's it for this week. Join me again for Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith.